Welcome, everyone, to We Rebel.
It's your two favorite hosts.
Yes. Unfortunately, Nick is on assignment in Botswana. Yes, he is chronicling the ever-elusive sea turtle, and he'll report back next week on that.
Yes. So we can't wait to hear from him.
Yes, but you do have Emily and myself here today. Guys, we have a really awesome interview.
Unbelievable.
With Lloyd Wilkie.
Yeah, so stick around for that.
Yes, he's an amazing activist. Who is sure to inspire you. So if you want to fast forward ahead a little bit to his interview, go ahead. But for now, we're going to talk about...
Stick around with us.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about what happened this week.
So,
in the USA.
Let's start off with our favorite Keebler elf, Jeff Sessions. Yes, he he gave his testimony to the House Judiciary Committee this week.
On Tuesday.
And once again, it's another case of his amnesia just popping up.
He really should see a doctor.
I would hope so. Or someone should step in, something, you know, write a journal, just chronicle the things you did. But so
quick little Outlook calendar. Like something. I said, again, export your calendar. I know your assistant has it.
Oh, someone's got to.
Someone's got it.
We're referencing a USA Today article by Aaron Kelly. Top takeaways from Jeff Sessions' testimony before the House Judiciary Committee. So Sessions essentially, after 5.5 hours... sort of, kind of, maybe recalls, this happened. So he says now he does remember being present at the March 31st, 2016 meeting that...
Again, just check your calendar.
Just check your calendar.
But, okay.
So that was the meeting that George Papadopoulos was at. He said he remembered... Sessions says he remembered it after seeing recent news reports about it.
Convenient.
So just, you know, you happen to be... Well, it's like, you know, in a movie where like something happens to be like going on that is, it applies to what's going on in your life.
Yeah. You're like, I see it everywhere now.
And now Jeff Sessions is like,
maybe we did.
Clue. I was there. I declare now that I was there.
I remember that.
And so he says he was there. And once again, like we know that Papadopoulos, he pled guilty to making false statements about these omissions. And so it's like, you know, you've got people coming forward saying, at least Will Papadopoulos is saying that he, you know, yes, I know I did this. And then why is everyone around him though? They're circling around it. They're like, nah, I wasn't there. Oh, wait. Yes, I was. And
here's the thing. I feel like no one's, if you're going to collude with Russia or set up these meetings,
I'm excited to see how this goes.
You're going to like. You want your plan to be airtight, you know, because like it's not like I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. Like, you know that collusion is against the law, question mark. We'll assume they say yes to that. Like, if you're going to do this stuff, it's like you got airtight plan, no holes in the plan. And now all we see is holes on both sides.
Yeah.
So
the only thing I want to point out about this testimony is that I did not watch the whole entire 5.5 hours. I have better things to do, but.
But you should watch it as an active American citizen.
Go back and watch. No, but you can see the way the Republicans and the Democrats, you know, in the way that they were speaking to Sessions. Sessions was using up people's time. If they were a Democrat, he was not answering directly. He, a lot of ums, ahs, I don't remember. Oh, maybe. But if it's a Republican asking him a question, first of all, they preface their statements by talking him up, him up as this great character, you know, and it's unfortunate to see, you know, at the heart of the matter, this is the American justice system, right? And we want to know that that our best interest is at heart with the people that are representing us. And when you have Sessions coming in and making a mockery out of the people questioning his tactics, questioning his memory, you know, this is not good. This isn't like you shouldn't be sitting at home cheering that he like, oh yeah, he schooled the liberals. Look at that. You should be upset.
It's too, even if you are a Republican, even if you think not that all Republicans believe that they didn't collude with Russia, even if you're Team Sessions and whatever degree that is, that's not the point here. This process is put in place so that we can, the American people can be protected. You know, like this process of going through an investigation and getting to the bottom of questionable things happening in our government, whether or not you are on the side of what actually ended up happening. You know, like the point of this testimony was to figure out what happened, not to like strategize or politicize it. Right. But obviously that happened.
Right. So, I mean, he's already perjured himself and, you know, he keeps saying like, well, I'm sorry. He says I didn't intentionally try to mislead you. It's like, but you know, if you keep forgetting and you know, Jared Kushner did the same thing. They just were talking about how he, you know, once again, has not given up all the information. Like, it's a lot. There's a lot of spotlight on you guys right now. You can't keep saying, oh, I forgot. Like, no, yeah. Now, because now it just seems, yeah, your collusion story, it's building.
Yeah. Just and tell us what happened.
It's going to look. Yeah. And speaking of collusion, let's talk to our favorite.
This is hilarious.
Our favorite internet troll, Donald J. Trump Jr.
This is hilarious.
I don't know if his middle name. I don't think his middle name is J. I don't know what the J stands for. Jackass, maybe. But
I'm gonna look
Donald Trump Jr. So in this article from The Atlantic by Bob Bauer, Donald Trump Jr.'s messages with WikiLeaks point to campaign finance.
John.
It does?
Donald John Trump is the 45th and current president of the United States.
Well, yeah, that's Trump, but I'm talking about his son. Donald Jr.
Hold, please. Keep talking.
Hold, please. Yes. So anyway, pointing towards campaign finance violations. So Donald Trump Jr.'s private Twitter correspondence with WikiLeaks.
Also Donald John Trump Jr.
Oh, like father, like son. Thing. So they're both terrible. Yep, okay. Yep. So, so his correspondence with WikiLeaks adds significant detail to the emerging picture of a political alliance between Trump, the campaign, and Russia in 2016. It provides evidence of criminal violations of federal campaign finance rules, which prohibit foreign spending in U.S. elections. So, which we kind of knew
whole,
that was.
This whole thing just cracks me up. Like, because, again, if you're going to, not that I'm like advocating for collusion, but like if you've ever watched an episode of any crime show ever, in what world was private Twitter messaging a way to communicate with the enemy?
Well, at least in a way that like no one was going to find out about.
Yeah, like of course someone's going to check your personal Twitter.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
It's sort of like how, well, you
like,
know.
Get a burner.
Well, it's like.
You know, like it's get a burner and then throw it in the ocean.
A burner
don't
Twitter.
Don't throw it in the ocean. I'm against littering. But you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, it's just like, not that I want people to collude with other countries and do bad things, but like, of all the things you thought they were going to hack into, you didn't think your Twitter account was going to come up?
Right. So, what is The Atlantic...
And then you're like, still forgetting things? Sorry.
You know, it's good. So, The Atlantic, they reported this last Monday. So, they were saying that in private Twitter messages that began in September 2016, it shows that WikiLeaks, which is the organization that the American intelligence community believes was chosen by Russia to disseminate information that it had hacked. They were basically looking for Trump Jr. to kind of help them out. All right. So what they did, they solicited support and they had requested that the campaign, quote, push a particular news story to a suggestion that Trump Sr. then tweeted out a link to the media and others to be able to see it. So the reason why it's so telling is because they send this message to Trump Jr. And then it just so happens about 15 minutes later, President Trump, then tweets it out. So, you know, the trail is right there. You know, you can't just pull that out of the, like
time stamped.
Right. And, you know, Trump Jr. then, which is, I think, an even stupider move. He then posts the tweets out that he's like, oh yeah, well, these are my messages that they sent me. Like, oh yeah, such a sign of collusion. Like, dude, you just displayed the evidence.
Yeah.
Like, what? These are the stupidest criminals.
Why are you not taking this seriously?
These are the stupidest criminals I've ever seen.
It leads me to believe that your father is not taking the office of the president seriously. But.
Oh, no. You can't seriously mean that, Emily.
Never.
But yeah,
it's just honestly, like, at this, like, I know I shouldn't think it's funny because this is serious and I literally just said that, but I can't even with this whole article because it's like.
Well,
it feels like I'm reading something from The Onion.
Well, it's just sad that we have to feel like we're, you know, how many times are we told, you know, like if you're of a liberal ideology or even just someone that opposes the Trump administration, they like, oh, you're snowflakes, you're weak, well, you're whining, you're so mad that Hillary lost. It's like, no, the people that are in charge of our country right now are treating it like a joke. And they're strong arming everyone else that they're supposed to be serving just so that they can benefit their own needs.
They're strong arming who they allegedly believe to be their colleagues.
Right.
To the point where people are quitting and being fired. Like, who's in the White House right now? Like, number of people, I don't know, way smaller than needs to be.
Nick would actually have the exact number, I'm sure. But But still, busy. He's busy with the sea turtles. But yeah, it's so you would hope that the idea of an administration, your representatives, that these are people working for your best interest. So when you see evidence like this between Sessions, between the Trump family, like all this stuff going on, yeah, it seems like a very dismal cloud. And yeah, and is. So hopefully, you know, something will come of this. Something we should talk about. I titled this "Greetings from Russia," Emily.
I do not respond with any sort of nice greetings.
She definitely doesn't correspond to Russia.
I don't.
Take this issue with a grain of salt.
Too
but
many
I'm,
Russian ballet teachers beat me to correspond.
But you know what? They are
anymore.
So flexible and so good.
But the teachers are mean.
They can be mean.
They make you cry.
Shout out to Slavka from U of M. She was awesome.
Shout out to Ramazan. Ooh. That's who I had in high school.
Nice. All right. So this next story I'm going to bring up, it's going to sound a little tinfoil hatty, but there's a reason for it. All right. So this
just
is
go on this journey with
so
us.
So go on this journey with us. Okay. So this is an article from BuzzFeed. So already one red flag.
Yeah. But, we realize.
But this article by Jason Leopold, Anthony Cormier, and Jessica Garrison. So secret finding: 60 Russian payments, quote, to finance election campaign of 2016. So on August 3rd of last year, just as the U.S. presidential election was entering its final heated phase, the Russian Foreign Ministry sent nearly $30,000 to its embassy in Washington. The wire transfer, which came from a Kremlin-backed Russian bank, landed in one of the embassy's Citibank accounts and contained a remarkable memo line, which was, quote, to finance election campaign of 2016. Now, this is one of 60 different transfers that the FBI has taken an interest in. In regards to the Russia's involvement into U.S. election.
Totaling more than $380,000.
Right. So that's a lot of money.
So that's more than what was spent on Facebook. So now we're up to $480,000 of possible collusion amount. Continue.
Exactly. All right. So it wound up at Russian embassies in almost 60 countries, from Afghanistan all the way to Nigeria, between August 3rd and September 20th of 2016. So it's not clear how these funds were used. So this is why I'm saying, like, the little tinfoil hat.
They're all earmarked, right? They were all earmarked with the tag.
With that tag. So at least one transaction that came into the U.S. originated with VTB Bank. Now, here's where it all comes back together, all right?
Here's where we have some things to say.
All right. So a couple weeks ago, and we've mentioned a few times, Felix Sater, all right? He was a business associate of Donald Trump who orchestrated that 2015 Trump Tower deal in Moscow. And he had promised to try to get Donald Trump elected as president. Okay. He's also the same guy that said he had really close ties with Putin. Well, that can be debatable whether he had those ties, Sater was getting that money for the real estate deal from
where?
VTB Bank. So
we're just putting it all out there.
Mm-hmm. So there's
keep doing our counter research. Let's all take into account this is BuzzFeed, but let's add it to our Russia war room.
Right. It's in the room.
Situational.
In folder 34A, you know, it's closed, locked up. But I mean, we say this to be aware, you know, like just like follow the clues. Maybe. I don't even know. Follow the clues.
Turn into a spy. I don't know.
But don't get arrested. Like don't
get arrested.
And
we don't advocate for arrest.
Yeah. I can't bail you out. I don't have that much money.
Yeah.
I'm
neither can
so
I.
Sorry.
Nick will bail you out though.
Oh yeah. He's loaded.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a true statement.
None of us have student loans. Anyways. It's just, again, you know, it's all, you always read things like this and then go do the opposite research, dig into VT Bank, the whole stuff. But we're just presenting it as a thing that is now in the world that we might know.
Yes.
So speaking of things that we now know.
All right. So let's first say this. I want to preface this. You know, we talk about, yes, we harp a lot about things that are, they tend to fall on the right wing side when it's like, hey, you know, people aren't being treated fairly, things like that. However, I think we have a duty as, you know, podcast hosts and people talking about politics that, like, if it happens on either side, it's wrong. It's wrong. So, so in this case, we're talking specifically about Al Franken. Mm-hmm. Referencing this article from the Washington Post by Amy B. Wang, Michelle Yihi Lee, and Lindsay Beaver. Al Franken kissed and groped me without my consent, Leanne Tweeden says, the senator responds. So broadcaster and model Leanne Tweeden said on Thursday that Al Franken, quote, forcibly kissed and groped her during a USO show in 2006, 2 years before he became a U.S. senator from Minnesota. Franken did apologize, though. So Tweeden wrote in her blog post, "You knew exactly what you were doing. You forcibly kissed me without my consent, grabbed my breast while I was sleeping, and had someone take a photo of you doing it, knowing I would see it later and be ashamed." Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, they both called for the Senate Ethics Committee to review these allegations on Franken. And Franken, you know, to his credit, he did say, "I will gladly cooperate." All right. He said, "There's more I want to say, but the first and most important thing, and if it's the only thing you care to hear, that's fine, is I'm sorry. I respect women."
Which I will say is a better thing than Roy Moore. Louis C.K.'s.
Oh, and Louis C.K. too. Yeah.
Alleged apology, which was not an apology.
Well, I think he put out one,
well,
the first one
was not an apology, and the second one is like, "Oops, I made a mistake. Let me hire someone to write me a real apology. Mm-hmm. So that's fine, and like, we can give him whatever version of credit that is, but like, it doesn't make it right. Mm-hmm. And I don't care that he was on SNL. I don't care that he's a Democrat. It's not okay.
Yeah. I'm treading water here. I think it's a better explanation of his actions, which he clearly is remorseful for and clearly knows he was in the wrong.
He's saying he's remorseful.
He's saying he's remorseful. Yes. And he even said like, "Yeah, please look into it. Do everything you need to do." I know a lot of people are calling for him to step down. However, Tweeden's response, actually, so she says, "Yes, people make mistakes. And of course, he knew he had made a mistake." She said she would leave any disciplinary action up to Senate leaders and was not calling for Franken to step down. She said, quote, "That's up to them. I'm not demanding that."
My problem with that is I don't trust our Senate leaders to make an appropriate disciplinary action plan. Mm-hmm. Because Lord knows that he is not the only Senate leader.
Oh, yeah. And that's been
cut too.
Well, cut too. Yeah.
You know,
Moore.
But it's
yeah,
just yeah. like, I mm-hmm. think that it is our role. It is our job to mm-hmm. demand that he step down.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
similarly yeah. to the current president,
because, well,
you know, like this is a irrevocable ethical mistake. That is forgivable in the sense that I believe that everyone can be forgiven, but not well. Like, if you're in public office, you're held to higher standards and you have to hold those standards. And if you don't, you get removed. Mm-hmm. Killing people, you get removed. Raping women, you know, sexually assaulting women, removed. Like, there's like, you have higher standards and you have to withhold those, and mistakes in public office are not really allowed. Those kinds of mistakes are not allowed.
All right. And unfortunately, the reason why it's such a hard argument for that right now is because we literally, a year after seeing these videos come out with Trump in the Access Hollywood bus.
I can't even. Yeah.
And still
here he is.
Still here he is
as president. Oval. Yeah.
You know? And yeah. So you want to foster the society where it's like, no, it is wrong to touch women in that way, to degrade them like that. You do not do that. And yet we rewarded this man with a presidency. So we have to just do better. And this even goes into the case of Roy Moore, where this week, you know, he made his public statements, you know, constantly going after the women that accused him, not taking any responsibility whatsoever, discrediting their stories. And you know, we have a lot to go towards. We have to fix these things. And yeah. one of the ways to do that is to point blank, don't vote for Roy Moore.
Yeah,
now that's one of
which five other three major Alabama newspapers mm-hmm. urge voters to not vote for Roy Moore.
Right.
To be clear,
so
we're not alone in that sentiment.
We are not alone in that. But now here's the thing: so we talk about like Roy Moore is bad. We don't need to support this. We don't need that. But we're not talking enough about Doug Jones. All right, and so there's more to vote for him other than being not Roy Moore.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
So I figure we should talk
Let's
a little bit about
that.
Who Doug Jones is. So this is referencing a CNN article by Carolyn Kenny. So Doug Jones, he's 63 years old. He's an attorney from Birmingham. He has never run for office before. All right. Ba-ba-ba. Look at that. So in 2016, Alabama voted for Trump with a 28-point landslide. So know that that's going on. They haven't elected a Democrat to the Senate since Richard Shelby was reelected in 1992. So he's got an uphill climb here. As of right now, he's doing better in like a pre-polling thing. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean anything, of course, as we know. So get out the vote. We'll talk about that in a second. But just a little bit more about Doug Jones. So in 1997, then President Bill Clinton named Jones as the United States attorney for the Northern District of Alabama in Birmingham. 5 years later, in 2002, Jones served as the lead prosecutor in the lawsuit against two of the four Ku Klux Klan members responsible for the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in September 1963. So for those who don't know about that, that's the act of racial violence that killed four African-American girls during church services. Jones was also involved in the prosecution of Eric Rudolph, whose 1998 attack on a Birmingham abortion clinic killed an off-duty police officer. In reference to that, Jones said, "Sadly, the pattern of violence as a response to hope has reasserted itself." He wrote, "We saw in the Charleston church massacre in 2015. We saw it on display in Charlottesville this past August. We've seen it in the attacks on mosques and synagogues and against the LGBT community. We see it in the hostility toward the Latino community. We cannot sweep this violence under the rug. We must address the forces that lead to it and prosecute those who perpetrate such acts." Jones won the Democratic primary in August. He defeated seven other candidates and taking home 63.6% of the vote. So this is a guy who, like, he's well-rounded. He's trying to help.
And yeah. He also is what you would consider, like, a moderate Democrat, which is a good spot to be in Alabama. You know, he had this whole quote-unquote kitchen table issues campaign, which focused on healthcare and the economy. And the economy is typically, you know, more talked about by the Republican Party than the Democratic Party. Nick would hit me for saying that. No, he wouldn't, because he doesn't hit women. He would be like, "What?"
He'd just make fun of you for saying...
He would make fun of me for saying...
Mueller.
Yeah, I can't even. He has to get over that. Yes. But it's, you know, he's one of those candidates that can and actively talks about reaching across the aisle, which is I think, a reasonable next step for Alabama. Mm-hmm. So those of our listeners in Alabama, get out and vote December 12th. It's right around the corner.
Yes.
Great.
Something we just got to hit it really quick.
We're going to hit it, like, and quit it.
But it just infuriated a lot of people. Okay, everyone knows about this. So earlier this week, Trump decided that the U.S. was now going to allow imports of elephant trophies from Zimbabwe and Zambia.
And it's just like, when I saw that, I was like, wait, of all the things we need to be doing right now, that's what we're gonna roll back on that.
And, like, I think everyone, like, kind of just froze because, like,
everybody was like, what?
You know, because here's the thing, we've dealt with a lot in a year with him, and it's longer really, because he had the whole campaign. But just, you know, you see this, and it's two things. It's one, incredibly cruel to these animals.
Yeah.
The elephants
what did the elephant do to you?
Smartest animals you'll find. They're best amazing. And they're the best memory, better than Jeff Sessions. I wish he could benefit from being an elephant. But not only that, but then it was just a straight up FU to Obama. It's just reversing something.
And the environment.
And the environment. You know, like,
don't understand what the initiation point was for that.
To redo everything, like, to tarnish anything Obama did in his legacy. No. And unfortunately, Trump is now, it's November right now. We're about to hit December. We're about to get, if they don't pass this tax thing, which we'll talk about in a second, if they don't pass a tax reform, Trump will have gone almost a calendar year without passing any significant legislation. All he has done is rescind things that Obama did in his presidency.
Rescind and stir that treason stew.
So as of Friday, though, Trump has put the reversal on hold, which it shouldn't even be on hold. It should just be off the table. Yeah. Don't do anything.
Until, quote, such time as I review all conservation facts.
Which he doesn't care about, because let's be honest, his sons have taken pictures and proudly, you know, posted them all over the place of them killing animals and posing with them.
So in response to this, dearest Ellen DeGeneres podcast favorite is raising some funds for an organization that helps you adopt elephants throughout the world to keep them not, or to make them less endangered. Help them live. I don't know what the right language is, but yeah. Keep an eye on it. It's just a complete ridiculous priority. I don't even understand why it's been brought up, aside from the fact that we have a crazy person.
Yes. All right, switching it up here.
Tax reform.
Yes. So it's the surprise of no one. It passed in the House. We do know that House and Senate have two different versions.
Which is hilarious.
You know, because no one agrees on anything anymore. Mm-hmm. But so the House, they passed 227 to 205. Again, that wasn't much of a surprise. We kind of knew that was going to happen. The big drama is going to be with the Senate. Because once again, you have a lot of senators that aren't necessarily on board, specifically speaking about those on the right. So you have Senator Ron Johnson, who's a Republican from Wisconsin. He's already said he won't vote for the proposal because of how it treats small businesses.
Yep.
Leaving Republicans with just one vote to spare when the plan hits Senate floor. Hopefully they're planning for after Thanksgiving.
Yep.
And then you've got Bob Corker from Tennessee. You got Jeff Flake from Arizona. They're worried about the plan costing more than advertised, thanks to the word temporary tax provisions being flown around. Because as many people have talked about, everyone's going to get it. You're supposed to, under this plan, you're supposed to get an immediate cut. And then after about 2 or 3 years, those under the certain threshold, I think it's under like, I think 50,000.
Yep.
You're about to get hit real hard. Like yep.
As soon as 2019. Right?
Yeah, 2019. Yeah, 2019, 2021, it's going to be even worse. So there's that. And then you have Susan Collins in Maine, who's concerned that about the plans to repeal the Affordable Care Act individual mandate as part of the tax reform. And then you have John McCain and Lisa Murkowski have their wild cards. We don't know where they're going to go, if it's a thumbs up, thumbs down. And so, you know, this tax plan is in shambles. And they have people, it's extremely unpopular. It's been polled everywhere. No one is really in favor of this.
And part of that, I think, is more so that it's very unclear as to what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, as you just said, it's a different in the House than in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Tax law in general is confusing to the average American because mm-hmm. they read it and then they're like, how does it affect me? And so our recommendation is dig into it as much as you can. Stay aware of how it's going to affect not only your personal situation, but to be honest, the disenfranchised communities around you, because those are the ones that are going to be hit the most. Another element that is important to highlight is that the overwhelming majority of taxpayers would no longer have access to make tax-deductible charitable contributions. The charitable tax deduction would be limited to the wealthiest of 5% of taxpayers. And I can tell you right now that most of your grassroots local organizations that are doing the work, which we'll talk about with our guest, is their donor base is not the 5% wealthiest of taxpayers. Those are the donors that are giving to your ballet companies, your orchestras, your thing where they can put their name on the building, your universities, which is valid and important and wonderful. But those are not the people that are giving $20 to $150 to the local youth basketball camp, you mm-hmm. know? So that is huge, not only for the people that are affected by those organizations, but also all of the jobs. There are a lot of jobs in those local small organizations. There's part-time workers who are moms. There's full-time workers who, you know, their salary is $40,000 a year, which is a good salary in a lot of places. And so that's going to affect both the workforce and the nonprofit sector, but also the beneficiaries of the nonprofit sector. And it's mm-hmm. hugely important because, again, most organizations are not funded by the wealthiest 5% of taxpayers. Boom. Right.
So like we said, look for that. That vote's supposed to be after Thanksgiving. You know, call your senators if you're concerned, yep. especially because they just added that whole repeal of Obamacare within this legislation. So call your senators. There's many ways to do that. You use ResistBot, which we've referenced many times, fivecalls.org. Get out there. All right, last thing we want to talk about.
This year, we're thankful for...
Oh, I guess we should do that. But I'm thankful for the impeach trees that are blooming.
That was the lead-in.
That was very good.
I'm also thankful for James.
I'm thankful for Emily. I just hit the table and it...
It's because he wanted to make a real emphasis. So sorry if that shocked you whilst driving.
We apologize to the listeners. All right. So this article from The Hill by Mike Lillis and John Bowden. House Dems introduce articles of impeachment against Trump. All right. So 6 House Democrats on Wednesday launched the latest official effort to oust President Trump, introducing
official keyword official. This is not a Facebook ad. This is not a drill.
They introduced 5 new articles of impeachment revolving around the central theme that the president is a danger to the country, which I think is true. Just going to put that out there.
Yes.
I don't have power, but so quote.
Yes, you do. You have the power to be an active, involved citizen, just like all our listeners.
That's true. All right. So they said, given the magnitude of the constitutional crisis, there's no reason for delay, said Representative Steve Cohen, a Democrat from Tennessee. Joining Cohen in endorsing the articles are Representatives Louis Gutierrez from Illinois, Al Green from Texas, Marcia Fudge from Ohio, John Yarmuth from Kentucky, and Adriano Espaillat from New York.
Well done.
Thank you. I tried. The lawmakers pointed to numerous actions by Trump they say make him unfit to be president, but they single out five actions they say rise to a level meriting impeachment.
Among those, yeah. Lawmakers mm-hmm. say Trump obstructed justice. Oh, yeah? What's
mm-hmm.
that?
Surprise.
When he fired former FBI Director James Comey, who was leading the federal investigation into Moscow's 2016 election meddling, as spoken of in this episode. Mm-hmm. And they're also accusing Trump of violating the Foreign Enrollments Clause, which bars public officials from receiving gifts. Oh, what's that? Gifts?
Oh, my.
Gifts from foreign governments without Congress's consent.
Yep.
And additionally, the clause that bars the president from profiting from his office. So basically, the Democrats say that the president has undermined two of the country's central institutions, the court and the press, and threaten the health of the nations.
And look, if you're questioning how that applies, you can talk Trump Tower for profiting off of, and also Mar-a-Lago really is like profiting off of him being in while he's in office. He's said on many occasions how he wishes he could silence media outlets. He's, yep. His office has done wonders in trying to silence those that like are, in their own press briefings. So, there's enough there that, you can bring this up. Of course, there's a lot of channels you have to go through in order to impeach a president. And you've got to get the Republicans on some sort of agreement with you to do that. And I don't see that happening right away.
Of course not.
However, these Democrats are taking the first step in doing that. And so we'll see if anything develops out of this. But for now, this is kind of the first blow.
And stick around.
Yeah.
For our guests.
Yeah, we have our amazing guest. Sorry, Lloyd Wilkie. He's, guys, this is going to be a fantastic interview. You're going to be so inspired by this man. So stick around. We will be right back.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back. I'm very excited to introduce our guest, who my cousin described to me as, quote unquote, in all caps, the nicest person in the world. We have Lloyd Wilkie on the podcast with us today, who is a local LA human relations consultant, trainer, facilitator, organizer, coach, and activist. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I mean, I was reading about you online and I was like, there's so many skill sets and places I could start asking you questions. So I guess I'll just start with, you experienced the LA riots.
Oh yeah, I sure did. In fact, that's my nickname, the LA riot.
Wow. What a moniker.
Yeah. Well, part of one of the jobs I hold is a boxing instructor. And I adopted that moniker to terrorize my opponents.
And that should strike some fear in people. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And so how did that moment in your life, if I read online correctly, you were working in finance, you were working at a bank, and then the LA riots happened. And then since that moment, you've had a wide, wild, crazy ride of a career working in anti-bias and racial relations and community and police relations. And so how did that moment kind of start your pivot?
Yeah, thanks. First, I'd like to, often people call it the LA riot, but it really was a rebellion. I'd like to put it in different terms. It was a rebellion against, the oppression that many people in Los Angeles were feeling on a daily basis. And it wasn't so much in the forefront of most other people's minds. And at some point, it just reached a boiling point, and it was a rebellion. Some call it a riot. Some called it civil disobedience. Others, called it many other things. But it was a rebellion. Mm-hmm. That moment was important for me because I was sort of focused on me. At the time, I was focused on my career in banking, and I had a little side gig of singing, so that was my other thing, mm-hmm. and so I was thinking about those things, but I also had a 1-year-old baby, And she inspired me every day to think differently about the world. And then when the city was on fire and I could look up in the sky and see the plumes of smoke and the helicopters and hear the gunshots in my neighborhood, I really kind of was holding my daughter and wondering what kind of life she was going to be introduced into in this city unless somebody did something. And mm-hmm. I felt like I had to do something, and I didn't really know what that something was because I didn't have any particular skill set, or at least I didn't think so, to do much in the community. But I just started to do some volunteer work, and one thing led to another and another and another. And here we are today, probably 25, 26 years later. I've sort of built my career around trying to bring healing to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. And because for those that are unfamiliar with the LA riots, you know, like you were saying, this is the height of a lot of tension, mm-hmm. a lot of unrest, you know, and things that we're still kind of dealing with today. Like, you know, just in the scene you were just describing now in LA, you know, people in Ferguson were going through the same thing after, you know, they felt, you know, that their voices weren't heard, that mm-hmm. the police were against them. And so, you know, what are the similarities you're seeing? Because it does seem a little bit cyclical, you know, like you went through that 20 years ago, there were the Detroit riots before that, you know, this seems to recur a lot. And what are you seeing in relation to that?
Well, I think that it's not something that's just reoccurring. It's just something that is consistent throughout U.S. history. You know, when you look long, you know, long term across our history, you see that there are systems and policies and things like that that, and just individuals who are really, I'd have to just say, attacking poor people, attacking people of color, attacking marginalized communities of all kinds. And, you know, unless we have activism, unless we have people who will stand against that, who will resist it, it will continue to go on that way. It's built into the cake.
Right.
You know, it's baked into the cake.
Oh, it's baked, and there are layers into that.
And, you know, we have to do what we can to try to reverse all that.
And so how do we even start? I mean, we've started and we've continued in different areas at different times in different ways. But, you know, for you, it sounds like you started a boxing program, and then also you were one of the first facilitators at the Museum of Tolerance's day-long seminar on diversity. So how did you kind of start peeling those layers away from this and create your career?
Thanks for the question, and again, thanks for the invitation. As I said to you when I came in, I've been storing up a lot of stuff, so I might unload on you.
That's
this
perfect.
Is the place to do it. Yeah,
we want it.
I should say that there are people out in the local LA community that are far more expert, far more competent, far more involved. You know, and I'll provide you with a list of those individuals that you might want to interview around these topics.
Perfect.
But today you got me.
And we're happy to have you.
And so I'll do the best I can to sort of represent on these issues. You know, I for a long time have just been trying to focus in on the things that I just see as injustice, right? I'm just trying to focus in on justice. And so that if that means racial justice, social justice, economic justice, you know, there are, when I look at my particular community, the Black community, how we are suffering in housing, healthcare, we're dealing with policing, immigration, the judicial system, mass incarceration, our education is a problem. Voting rights are a problem. These are all areas where I feel like we're being attacked mm-hmm. by, you know, frankly, this particular administration has done a real yeoman's job of attacking my community in those areas and many more. I'm sure I missed a few. And so, you know, what I've been trying to do is get involved in a movement to resist all of that. And from where I sit, I find myself often at odds with the folks on the left, and sometimes at odds with folks on the right, because as you mentioned, sometimes, you know, part of my career is that I work to train law enforcement, right? I work, as you mentioned, for the Museum of Tolerance in their Tools for Tolerance program to try to do the diversity work that is the requirement for all LAPD, LA County Sheriffs, and many other agencies across the state and across the country. I started doing that work shortly after the rebellion. I've been involved in trying to create dialogue between the community and the police department. That was something else I did as a part of a program that's called Days of Dialogue, right? Which was something that was started, you know, in the wake of those, of the unrest. But at the same time, you know, I'm critical, and I am someone who, especially at this stage in my life, I'm speaking out against injustice more and in favor of changes in structures and policies and stuff that I think will benefit us in the long run. So sometimes I find myself at odds with those people who I spend a lot of time with, the police, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes I also find myself at odds with my activist community because I'm maybe not radical enough, you know? Yeah. And so I'm trying to balance that and trying to, in my own thinking, be pragmatic about what it is that we could achieve in my lifetime toward, you know, saving some lives.
Yeah. And so in your work with the LAPD then, you know, what are the steps that you take with them and what kind of communication are you trying to get to achieve between them and the community that they serve for?
Mm-hmm. I have lots of ideas about how we could evolve our thinking around law enforcement training. I haven't yet had the opportunity as a lead person in that, you know, to be able to put forth my ideas. Mm-hmm. So what I've been able to do, though, is implement the ideas of other people who are quote-unquote experts.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, and as you can see by the data, what little there is, sometimes I'm wondering if we're having any impact, okay?
Yeah.
So therein lies my conflict. You know, where I think maybe we need to be pushing harder. Mm-hmm. I can only do what I can do. In those moments, what we're trying to do is create awareness, right? So we create awareness around these various issues that are present within the exhibits in our museum, and within the discussions that we then hold, right? And there are some workshops that are offered to assist officers in helping them to learn different, more effective strategies for dealing with the public. Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm sure, you know, with the country at large, probably the numbers aren't drastically shifting, but have you noticed a change just in LA alone with like the little bit of work that you've been able to do? Have you found there are some advancements? Okay.
I wish that were true. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to, before I leave here, I want to make sure that I got a chance, since you're talking about Los Angeles, that locally, mm-hmm. there are a couple things that I've mainly been focused on that I think are really important, you know, and I would like for your listeners, especially if they're local LA-based mm-hmm. listeners, to hear about. The number 300 is really important to me right now. On the one hand, we have 300 civilians have been killed by the police since our current DA has been in office in LA County. Her name's Jackie Lacey, right? 300 civilians have been killed by the police since she came into into that office, and there have been zero prosecutions.
Wow.
Right. Hmm. So I just want that to just, you know, just sit with that for a minute. What I guess we're to understand from that is that every one of those shootings was justified, right? Mm. Every time that occurred, you know, it was okay. It was either within policy or it was a justified killing, right? So we have to just assume that, and maybe we should pat ourselves on the back that we have such great police officers roaming our streets, mm. right? So that's the one. Number 300. The number 300 also appears that our current sheriff, McDonald, has identified through his own sources within his department that there are 300 problematic deputies in his employ right now, right? And by that, I think his report states that if any of these deputies gets called up on a trial, these are problematic people that are not trustworthy,
mm-hmm.
hmm.
right? They have in some ways been tainted in some way, right? And I don't know which way that might be, but you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that list that he compiled, he cannot share that list with the DA, who is likely to call one of those persons as a witness in a case, right?
Mm.
Because the union has sued to make sure that that list does not go further than where the sheriff compiled it, right? It's very powerful, these unions, and mm-hmm. how they're able to protect their own. So that number 300, I just popped that out there because it's mm-hmm. easy for your listeners to remember. 300 problematic deputies are out there right now, and 300 people have been killed by the police under the watch of this this LA County DA that we have right now, and there have been no prosecutions. Those are two things that, you know, I'm kind of pushing mm-hmm. to the forefront as much as I can.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that it's just so striking, you know, it's not that I, because we hear about this all the time. Like, you know, there's even a story this past week that a Philadelphia officer, you know, he stole drugs out of their own like department, like they had, and they gave it to a Baltimore police officer so he could sell them. So, you know, like there's corruption all over, like that stuff happens. And so when we hear about this, we hear about 300 civilians, you know, being killed and no justice being taken. You know, are people coming to you? Like what are their concerns? What, you know, is it a feeling of helplessness? Like what can we do? Cause it's striking and it's scary. You know,
it's frustrating. And there are a lot of angry people, right? I am a part of a movement of people who are trying to bring these things up, who are causing a lot of disruptions in public, right? Mm-hmm. We're making a lot of noise, and people are being made uncomfortable by that, mm-hmm. right? That's what a protest is. Protest, by definition, is disruption. You can't go about your daily life and not think about these things because they are impacting mine and you're going to know about it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's kind of what is the position of many of the folks in the activist community, right? Something has to change. You've heard the phrase, no justice, no peace, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some people have, you know, been laughing at that, but it's true. That it is what it is. That's what it is. If you'll hear people chanting, if we don't get no justice, you don't get no peace.
Mm.
Right. And so, you know, I'm there with them on that. Right. And at the same time though, as I said before, I'm trying to find other ways to impact that system that is creating so much havoc in our community. I'm trying to influence in some way police culture,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe it's a futile effort. I don't know. Some people think I'm crazy for trying, but someone's
got to, right?
No, it's yeah. We've seen that time and time again with our activists that we interview, that there's the loud group rally petition, show up, continue show up approach. But then there's also that daily get in the room with the person that is in charge. It's like you have to protest the system, but also get in through the cracks of the system and break the system down at the same time.
But that's, I find something interesting that you said earlier about trying to find the pragmatic solution, because it's you know, there are the, everyone's gonna, on both sides are going to think the other one's doing it wrong, right? And then maybe that somewhere in the middle is the answer that we need, and maybe that's the there's a compromise in the middle. But you know, but you've got to get, you know, there are people, even liberals, that are like not agreeing with the Black Lives Matter movement, and they're like, well, we don't like the way they're handling that, and why are they crying this, and blah blah. And so like, if no one is working together, how are we getting forward?
Right.
You know.
So you know, here's the truth. We like to think of things in this binary way, right? There's us and there's them. The truth is, there is no them. There's only us. That's all there is.
Yep.
And when we all figure that out, I don't know, maybe someday we'll get there.
Yeah.
I'm curious, in your world where you're talking to the system, you know, how do you open these anti-bias workshops? Because I feel like it's such a loaded, everyone comes in with their own experience of whatever background they are, and then their own bias of whoever is in the room, layered on top of the fact that they're at the Museum of Tolerance, layered on top of the fact that this happened in their morning. You know, how do you get through all of that? I don't want to say baggage, because that's got a negative connotation, right. But sometimes it is baggage.
It's baggage.
To get the room to the point where you can have these conversations. Right. How do you do that?
Yeah, sure. We acknowledge the baggage. It's there. You brought it with you. You know, everybody in here has it. And so we want to examine the baggage. That's what I want to do. I want us to first do some self-awareness raising, right? To look at ourselves. Who are we? It's a big question. Who are you? And so we have that as our start. You know, let's talk about your identity. Let me talk about my identity. We start having a conversation about who we are. We can start hearing stories back and forth about our experiences, our lives, and what has made us believe the things that we believe, right? We understand a little bit better. We may not totally understand the other person, sure. But we can kind of get, okay, you know, I disagree with you. I, you know, matter of fact, I hate you, but at least, you know, at least I now understand how you got from point A to point B.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. I disagree with it, but okay, I understand how you made the journey.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when we start talking about the journey, then people can kind of get on the same plane about the understanding that we all have a journey. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So, all right. Now that we've established that, we can move into some real work around, you know, the things that you described, anti-bias work, you know, bias. You've probably heard the word implicit bias, right? Those are loaded terms for folk. You know, when you get to talking to a group of people about implicit bias, sometimes they think you're charging them with racism,
right?
And so we have to dispel that. We have to look at it, and we have to describe what we mean by implicit or unconscious bias. We have to have some deep, you know, conversations about what it is and how it develops. And then, okay, now we all know. We all got it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Have you seen any sort of change over time in what that bias conversation looks like from when you started doing these workshops to the present day?
Oh, yeah. When I first came into this work, the demographics of, you know, police departments was very different, right? And so those conversations were really different then, right? They were anxious conversations, because we were just coming off of the, you know,
sure,
the disruption, rebellion. Right? And there weren't a lot of officers of color, and there were very few women. And so those conversations were very different. Now those conversations are very different, because we have some changes in the demographics. And I tell you, one of the interesting and some of the best conversations I've had around this stuff have been with recruits. So we spend a lot of time with those who are recruited in, and before they graduate, they have to spend about an 8-hour day with us. And those young people are very different, you know, than they used to be. Mm. They come from all sorts of backgrounds all across the county, and they are very idealistic, and they are very passionate about wanting to help people, right? I love having that conversation with them.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that I want them to know that there will be a lot of stuff that's going to come up in the next 5 to 7 years that's going to push your buttons and push you possibly in the other direction. And I want you to know ahead of time that it's coming. And I want you to be aware of it, and I want you to resist it. You know?
Yeah.
That's kind of it.
Mm. Well, that's inspiring, though. It's good to know that there's another generation of kids. They want to do something.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's
especially refreshing. You know, an article just came out recently in the LA Times that said that hate crimes linked to white supremacists jumped 67% in 2016. So hearing stats like that, or your 300 stats, it's so challenging. But then it's like, okay, what you just said about the new recruits coming in feeling passionate is making me a little more optimistic. So,
yeah. So what would you say? So there's, you know, there's the kids you've worked with out here, and then, you know, we've got listeners all over the country right now. So, you know, if you were to say something to them about getting involved and starting their path of activism, what would be your advice to them?
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned that, here's the interesting thing. A lot of times when we start talking about these statistics about police brutality and killing, right, the finger will point back at me, and people will say, well, what about all that black on black crime that's going on in your community?
Oh, yeah.
You're killing yourselves. And, you know, and I get that argument. Just for your listeners to understand that, you know, there are a lot of people in my community multitasking on a daily basis on that. Okay. That we're not just sitting in our community and feeling fine about all of the community violence that's happening around us and just focused our attention on the state violence, which is being perpetrated against us. There are many of us out here who are doing a lot of different work with young people. And, you know, if we had our priorities straight in this city, think about this for a second. The LAPD budget is almost $2 billion.
Whoa.
Did you know that?
I did not know.
I did not know it was a B.
Can you think, with a B?
With the B.
Okay.
Now, don't know what that means.
And they, you know, how is that working with the crime rate? Right? Is it, you know, they recently they claimed that the crime rate had dropped, but then somebody found out later that they had been cooking the books, you know, on the crime rate. So they, you know, law enforcement loves to pat themselves on the back when crime rates drop, but they don't point to the many community-based organizations who are out here doing the work, right? And I could name a thousand of them. In fact, I'll send you links and whatever.
Yes, so
please. Yes, you, please do.
And in my case, you know, I started a little boxing program. I work with about 30 students a week. You know, 2 days a week we teach boxing, but it's really a leadership development program, and we've been trying to do our bit in our communities to do what we can to lessen violence that is occurring, and I feel like we're really effective, and in fact that's what works to lower the crime rate is community-based solutions to these issues, right? Not more and more excessive policing. That's not what drives the crime rate down. That, in fact, exacerbates it, I think.
Yeah.
I think what would work is if we maybe had 1% of the LAPD budget.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Just think about that for a second.
Be re-granted to those organizations. Absolutely.
Yep.
Yes.
Right. We could really get the crime rate down for real.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, it's just, you know, it's a struggle, and it's frustrating for many of us in our communities to have to deal with all this stuff. But, you know, if I were to speak to folks across the country, anybody, whoever's listening, you know, and wanting to think about getting involved in some ways in their community, just think about whatever you're passionate about. I just happen to dig boxing. Mm. Truth be told,
confession time.
Here's the confession time, and some of my students out there will be shocked to know this. I've never boxed anybody, really. Right? But it's not about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not really about that, right? I've boxed with some teachers and coaches and and other mm-hmm. students, right? I'm undefeated among eighth graders.
Look at that. And look at that record.
That's more than I can say about boxing.
Oh, they can take me out. It would happen in an instant. Oh, yeah.
Definitely take Nick out. Hands down.
And Nick, no contest.
Right. So it's not really about that. It's find what you're passionate about. Bring that to the table.
Yeah.
Right. If you can do that, do that. You know, I just want people to know the things like I mentioned earlier, the 300, you know, problematic mm-hmm. deputies. If you know that, then there might be something you could do about that. The 300 civilians killed by the police and the DA's doing nothing about it. You know, there's petitions that are floating around about that right now. We're pushing one right now, and we're trying to get people activated around that. Those are specific things. If you hear about, you know, budget priorities, you know, mm-hmm. come on. That 1%, just 1% of LAPD budget. You know, here's another interesting thing. I spent recently a day at a camp. A detention camp for young men up in the mountains in Whittier, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a probation program where they're teaching young men to be firefighters. And they are fantastic. You should see them. These men are outstanding as firefighters. Mm-hmm. And whenever there's a fire out there
sure.
in the neighborhoods here, mm-hmm. right, they send them out. And they go out and they fight these fires for like $2 an hour.
Right? Wow.
I just want you to think about this a little bit, right? Because when I was up there and, you know, the probation people were showing me all this stuff and I was dialoguing with the young men that were there and stuff, and probation folk were really proud of what they were doing. And yeah, it's a great program. I could see how it instilled a lot of values in these young men and how it gave them tools to use in the future. Well, actually, not so much, because if they have a felony, they can't become a firefighter when they get out.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right, so that there's that part, mm-hmm. right? And then the other part that got me was, God, you know, the one of the probation guys asked one of the students, "Do you know how much those boots cost that we got you?" And they were like $400 a pair for each inmate for those special firefighter boots, and they had uniforms and helmets and packs mm-hmm. and all sorts of gear. Costs a fortune, I imagine, you know, in mm-hmm. taxpayer money to fund this program. So it's a real commitment on the part of LA County to train these young firefighters
yeah.
who can't become firefighters, you know. But mm-hmm. anyway, what's interesting to me is, why couldn't we have put that money up front?
Yeah.
Right? You know, we could have put a firefighter training academy in each high school.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
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 From the beginning.
From the beginning.
Yes, before the felony. Yep.
Before the felony.
Or mm-hmm. any version, you know, before the misdemeanor.
Before the misdemeanor.
Before mm-hmm. the bad grades.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
This is one of those areas that yep. I think about a lot. I stand around thinking too much maybe sometimes. But, you know, if those people who are out there listening, you know, are interested in really seeing crime rates drop, in seeing community unity and less violence, and wanting to lower the incarceration rates and get some sense of actually national security is connected to this. Mm-hmm. If those folks are really interested in that, they should look at issues like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Where is the money going? Who is benefiting from these programs? And think about things that are investments in education, right? We now have probably a more segregated school system than we had in 1954
mm-hmm.
when the Brown v. Board decision mm-hmm. came down, right? And if you look at education, it's going to get worse. Under this administration, investments in things that do prevention, intervention, restorative justice, restoring individual back to the communities, rehabilitation and reentry programs. Those are the things that we need in our communities to solve these big problems that, you know, everybody seems to be worried about. And if you have any way to influence that, whether it's by your vote or where you spend your money, mm-hmm. You know, I'm done with Christmas. I'm done with it.
Yeah.
I'm not spending my money in those stores that are stocking the shelves with products that were built by prisoners in prisons, in private prisons. I'm not going to invest in that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking to tell people, you know, be clear about how you spend your money and how you don't spend your money, and redirect your money. You know, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, if you must have a Merry Christmas, spend it with some black people.
Yeah. Yeah. Buy some local artists.
Black businesses. On, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Or local businesses.
Local businesses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
This is, I've never felt so guilty about ending a podcast.
I know. I feel like I've so many more questions.
I feel like we need to have you, like,
a
please come
of
back.
Information.
Please come back. We need, I feel like there's so much more we need to talk about.
Thank you.
Yes. With you. But Lloyd Wilkie, I mean, thank you so much. Guys, I hope everyone that's listening is inspired, because all it takes is, again, something passionate,
yep.
something that you are passionate about. And, you know, it can start so small. It can be just an interest you have. And then, yeah, it could lead to being in office and things like that. But there are just there's so many things on the ground that you can do to help your next door neighbor, you know? Mm-hmm. So please think of all those things that really speak to you and get involved in any way you can. So that's it for today.
Yep.
So if you would like to follow us, we are We Rebel Podcast on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. If you send us an email at werebelpodcast@gmail.com.
We will respond and be very happy.
Yes.
And if you want to follow Lloyd, he's on Twitter at Mindful Policing and on Facebook at LA Riot Boxing.
Yes. And then, of course, catch us at whatsacreative.com and Apple Podcast. Until next week, have a happy Thanksgiving. Yes.
Oh, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. All right. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?
Lorraine, and I'm black.
I'm Sarah, and I'm Jewish.
Hey, Lorraine, do you ever feel like there's stuff you're supposed to know about as a black person, but, like, you don't?
Ugh, you mean, like, how I should have seen Roots or read any of Langston Hughes' poems?
Wait, you haven't read Langston Hughes? He's so good.
I'm sorry. Have you ever even seen Mel Brooks' comedy classic Spaceballs?
Dude, you know I haven't seen Spaceballs. Why you gotta bring that up?
Anyway, we have a podcast. It's called Learned Up.
We're learning basic black and Jewish stuff so we can cross it off the list and feel less guilty. I ate my first Reuben. It was awesome.
And I played for the WNBA. Just kidding. Go on ahead to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Learned Up.
Let's get Learned Up!